Chapter 29. Papara, Tahiti. Atta drew himself up to his full height and brought his spear hand back behind his head. The tattoos on his heavily muscled shoulders and back danced in the bonfire's shadowy orange light, and the crowd of villagers, seated on logs and rocks in a semicircle behind the warrior, held their collective breath in anticipation of his next move. His left leg was planted a few feet behind his right. His left arm was crooked and raised to chin height, and his torso was turned slightly to the right. At the instant his arm began to propel the spear forward, he would whip his torso back to the left and use the additional momentum to send the spear hurtling towards the target with astonishing speed. Many of the villagers had seen Atta split small trees in half with a single throw, and his bravery, taking on huge wild boars, whose razor-sharp tusks could open a man's leg to the bone with one slashing motion of its bristled head, was legendary around the island. But his target tonight wasn't a tree or a boar. 40 feet from where he stood, ready to loose his spear, was a gnarled tree with a Y-shaped trunk. A man was planted upside down against the tree, his head resting on the dirt, and his legs splayed wide and tied to branches with braided cord. Nestled in his crotch was Atta's target, a large, unhusked coconut. The upside-down man was in his 20s, shirtless, and wearing only loose linen trousers. His arms were stretched out to the ground, and Thomas could see that he was gouging his fingers into the soft dirt. Not surprisingly, rivulets of sweat were pouring off his chest and face and dripping onto the soil. If Aata's aim was off by only an inch up, down, or to either side, the man would either lose one of his legs, have his abdomen pierced, or feel his manhood nailed to the bark by the razor-sharp spear tip. Thomas turned and made eye contact with Captain McNabb, who was seated on a stump a few feet away beside Chief Varua and the chief's sister, Ke'ani. In reply, McNabb shrugged and shook his head. None of the 100 villagers gathered around the fire showed any concern about what was happening. Why should he or Thomas raise any objection? The damn fool tied to the tree had apparently offended the spear-wielding warrior while fishing earlier that day, and Aata's honor could only be restored in the eyes of his people with a very public display of humiliation and penance. If that meant some poor fool's balls could end up being pinned to the tree like a butterfly in a school child's science display, so be it. This was the Polynesian way. It had been a day of contrasts and extremes. Thomas and McNabb wheeled their horse-drawn cart into the center of the scattering of thatched huts and wood shacks that made up the seaside village of Papara, just after noon. Boswell rode in an hour later after being sidelined by the sight of an unfamiliar flowering bush that smelt of burnt sulfur and peppermint. Chief Varua had just completed his midday meal and came out under a covering woven with reeds and palms, where several women were working over low, domed ovens. McNabb and the chief embraced, and when the captain introduced Thomas, he was struck by how the darkness of Varua's eyes contrasted with his wide, snow-white smile. Like most Tahitian men, Varua wore a baggy, buttonless cotton shirt over lightweight trousers that were chopped off just below the knee. His long jet-black hair was held against the back of his neck with a blue ribbon, and a 10-inch pearl-shell knife dangled from his belt.
"Welcome home, old friend,"
said the chief as McNabb leaned up over the wall of the wagon to retrieve a wooden box. Varua's eyebrows went up and his smile widened further when he saw the word cognac stenciled on the side.
"A dozen bottles of cognac frappin'," said McNabb with a smile. "Just enough for us to conduct our pearl shell negotiations."
Varua pried the lid off the box with his knife and pulled out a single dark brown bottle.
He unwrapped the cork, pulled it out, and took a deep smell.
"Heaven," he said. "And to think you are able to get a full case even as the grape phylloxera is ravaging the vineyards in France where it is produced."
He held up the bottle for Thomas to see and added,
"This is Frappin's 600th year producing the nectar of the God's kernel. I am truly a lucky man."
Thomas cast a sidelong glance at McNab, as if to say, "We are 10,000 miles and several centuries of civilization from Paris, and yet this tribal chieftain of an isolated village, miles from anywhere, is a connoisseur of fine cognacs?"
McNab grinned. He knew what Thomas was thinking.
"Chief Arua is a man of many talents, Colonel. I highly recommend against engaging him in cards."
The chief laughed and led them to a stone bench at the edge of a creek that spilled into the lagoon. He waved to the open-air kitchen, and two women brought plates of fruit, fresh baked bread, and several empty glasses.
"I am sorry that Aubert is not here to enjoy this moment," said Varua, as he filled three glasses and motioned for the men to sit. "His heart will be broken, but he chose to paint on the other side of the mountain, while I chose to attend to my duties."
He raised his glass, and they drank deeply of the aromatic liquid that tasted of dried fruit, dark chocolate, and caramel.
"Extraordinary," was all that Thomas could say.
McNab nodded his head in agreement.
"But have no worries for Aubert," he said to Varua. "I brought a case for him as well, and also a box of paints and brushes and a roll of fine canvas."
"Tell me, Colonel," said Varua as he topped off their glasses, "what has brought you to Tahiti, and, more importantly, out here to the edge of nowhere? You don't appear to be a businessman, and unless France and the United States have declared war, you are not here to do battle."
Thomas started to speak, but McNab laid a hand on his forearm and answered for him.
"Colonel Scoundrel is sitting out a dangerous situation," said the captain. "I would like for him to stay here for a week or so while I tend to some business, and then he will come back with me to Matavai Bay. Until
those who are pursuing him give up the chase and turn back to America,"
the chief interrupted. How and why? Thomas wondered. How could Varua know about Donegan and Stafford and their quest to have him killed? The chief's eyes sparkled.
"No mystery, Colonel," he said. "Men only come here for a few reasons. To sell and buy and paint and study," he lowered his voice, "or to hide. McNab is a buyer, Aubert is an artist, and Boswell is a scientist. You strike me as being none of those. And so, if you are one who needs to hide, there must be someone you're hiding from. A simple deduction."
"But you have left out a category of visitor, friend Varua," said McNab. "The missionary. Surely you don't think he come here to hide from the authorities?"
"Ah, but Captain, I have included the missionary. He is here to sell."
McNab looked perplexed.
"Salvation comes at a cost, does it not? There is an exchange of value between sinner and savior, and the missionary is the middleman in the transaction."
The chief smiled at his own cleverness. "Fill my glass, Varua," grumbled McNab, "and let's talk about the next peril shell delivery." That evening, Thomas, McNab, and Boswell joined dozens of villagers under a balmy, star-swept sky for a dinner of whole roast pig. The animal had been salted before its carcass was filled with hot stones and placed in hardwood coals. Then more hot stones were placed on top of the pig, beneath layers of flattened banana tree brush, tea leaves, and several inches of soil.
Slow cooking in an emu oven was a Polynesian tradition that went back centuries, Boswell explained when they were handed ceramic plates piled high with the succulent shredded pork alongside local fruit that had been liberally marinated in sweetened rum punch.
"Food of the gods," said Boswell as he watched the expression on Thomas's face when he took his first bite.
"I have to agree," Thomas replied. Then he turned to Chief Varua and nodded his appreciation. McNabb leaned over and whispered something into the chief's ear.
"Is it true, Colonel, that you are an authority on fine wine?" asked Varua.
"I am becoming one, at least as my pocketbook permits," Thomas answered with a smile.
"And what wine would you serve with roasted pork?" continued the chief.
"Something with a bit of fruit and good acidity, I would think."
"A Beaujolais, perhaps?"
Thomas nodded agreement between bites, and Varua turned to his sister and said something that Thomas could not hear. She rose from her seat and walked swiftly away from the fire in the direction of the chief's residence.
"You say Keani is mute?" Thomas asked Boswell.
"Since birth, though it seems not to have held her back in any way. I understand she was educated by the missionaries and is something of a famous reader. McNabb regularly brings cases of books for her library, and I dare say she has read each of them at least twice. A priest also trained her in French Galladay, hand language, and she has taught several of her friends how to speak with their hands as well."
"She seems so young. Do I understand that she was married?"
"At 14, Boswell answered. "Varua wanted to build an alliance with a neighboring chief to lobby for a better yearly stipend payment from the queen of all the chiefs. 3 months after the wedding, her husband was killed when his fishing boat overturned on a coral reef. Nasty death, I was told." He held up a fork full of pork. "Apparently, his body was shredded on the razor-sharp coral spines, just like this exceptional pork."
Thomas grimaced. "And now she is
20 and happily single," said the botanist. "Dedicated to her brother, and shows no interest in remarrying, though I am told that Aata has been an unrelenting suitor."
"She's not interested?" Thomas asked.
"He can't read, and he is unwilling to learn," said Boswell. "She requires literacy as a condition for even considering matrimony, though I suspect that Chief Varua is growing tired of her refusing every man who asks him for her hand. He has no heirs, and so he expects Keani to marry and produce a healthy male child, so that his seed will continue to rule Papara for generations."
Before Thomas could reply, Keani returned with a small burlap sack and a tray of 5 wine glasses. She handed glasses to her brother, McNabb, Thomas, and Boswell, and then withdrew 2 bottles and a wine opener from the bag and gave them to her brother. Varua held up a bottle in the firelight for Thomas to see.
"Beaujolais Nouveau, made from the Gamma Noir à Jus Blanc Grape, a gift from my friend Louis-Henri Denis Jadot, who first visited Tahiti 5 years ago and carried with him 2 dozen cases of the nectar. Sadly, Beaujolais has a rather short cellar life, and so I must rely upon my purchasing agent in Papeete and the services of good men like Captain McNabb to keep it flowing from France on a regular basis."
Varua opened the bottles and filled their glasses, which Keani handed to the guests before filling her own glass. At the instant she handed Thomas his wine, a shower of sparks from the great fire in the center of the village common area shot up into the clear night sky. He was so startled that he pulled back and put his open hand on her elbow to steady himself on his wooden chair, without spilling a drop of wine, he was proud to note. Keani smiled and rested her hand briefly on his shoulder
before returning to her brother's side. Thomas took note of two things in that instant. First, he had not realized how beautiful Keanu was, and second, he felt the heat of A'ata's intense stare even before he saw the warrior glaring at him through the flames for sharing so intimate, though harmless, a moment with the woman A'ta claimed as his own. Boswell saw it too. He took a sip of his wine and said,
"I suggest you keep your ship tied tightly to the dock, my friend. This is one storm you do not want to sail into."
Thomas shrugged and inhaled the bright, fruit-filled aroma of the Beaujolais before taking a deep drink. McNabb and Varua were deep in conversation, and Boswell's attention was suddenly diverted by a young boy who brought him a basket of unusual flowers that bloomed for only a day or two each year. Thomas looked past Varua to where Keanu was gazing into the heart of the fire. In the orange light of the flames, her forest green eyes seemed to glow. Encircling her head was a simple wreath of fern mixed with leaves that were dotted with small white flowers. Her olive complexion skin was unblemished, and her nose turned up slightly at the tip, giving the suggestion of a mischievous personality. Her dark brown hair was naturally parted in the middle and spilled into soft curling waves down below her breasts. But the loose, sleeveless white linen dress that went down to her bare feet gave no hint about the contours of the body that it covered. Keanu felt his gaze and turned her head to look directly into his eyes. Her expression was a mix of curiosity and welcome. But before Thomas could rouse himself enough to even think of saying something to her, a shout went up on the far side of the bonfire. Everyone stood as three men marched the hapless victim of A'ata's anger over to the Y-shaped tree, turned him upside down, and spread-eagled and lashed his legs to the trunk. When an elderly woman walked saucily over to the man and gently lay a coconut on his upended crotch, the crowd realized what was going on and began to cheer.